Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. And let's see, it is Thursday, February 4th. All right, you guys, come to order. And we're going to finish up chapter 3, move into chapter 6 today. So let's quickly review some things, namely protein synthesis. You should know how many steps are involved in protein synthesis?
Two.
What's the first step? Transcription, where does that take place? In the nucleus. So a gene has to be turned on. Most genes are turned off, and then they're turned on when a particular protein needs to be made. And how can your body turn various genes on and off? There's a couple important regulatory mechanisms for that. What needs to bind to a gene before transcription can take place? It's called a transcription factor. Transcription factor binds to a gene, okay, and that can start initiation. All right, but before even a transcription factor can bind to a gene to initiate transcription, something else has to happen. The DNA has to be unwound, unraveled. It has to be extended to reveal the gene so that transcription factor can get at that segment of DNA. What was that chemical reaction that allows the unwinding of DNA off of those nucleosomes? It's called acetylation. Acetylation. Right? So that's another control mechanism. That's a little switch that can control protein synthesis, right? All right, so that happens inside the nucleus, and then what's the second step? Translation, right? And where's the workbench where translation takes place? That's right on the ribosome, right? And you got a couple places where you find ribosomes. Where do you find ribosomes inside the cell? Two main locations. On endoplasmic reticulum, making it rough, and free ribosomes in the cytosol, right? The fate of proteins built by free ribosomes is intracellular. The fate of proteins made by rough endoplasmic reticulum, they're going to be modified or modified and secreted outside the cell. They're part of a secretory pathway. All right, all this brings to mind something that I forgot to mention about one of the organelles, an important bullet point, and that is smooth endoplasmic reticulum. You all know the function. What did we say the function of smooth ER was? Yeah, lipid synthesis. But there's another important role for smooth ER, and that is that it can store calcium ions. All right, so make sure you're aware of that. You're going to be really aware of that by the time the class is over, but that might be a good thing for you to know now so that it doesn't seem strange when we see that later on. All right, so what good is calcium in the body? What good is calcium? If you're going to pick an important function of calcium. Nobody's really sure. Okay. Well, we're going to make a big deal of calcium in here, so just stay tuned. All right, so protein synthesis requires transcription in the nucleus. The RNA leaves the nucleus, goes into the cytoplasm, and then translation takes place. Those are the two main steps. All right, so where did we leave off? We left off right about here. This is a really cool slide. I wish it had just one other detail to it, but this is a good slide, so you might have to make a lot of notes on this one right here. Let me get my pointer options going. So if you're familiar with this one, you're going to be in really good shape. All right, so we're interested in looking at DNA, we're interested in looking at RNA, and we're interested in looking at proteins. All right, so make sure you know the building blocks for each of those major kinds of chemicals. All right, so what's the building block of DNA? Nucleotides, in particular, deoxyribonucleotides. You should know the four main bases that make up DNA, which are? And you can tell me in terms of, I tell you what, you can tell me in terms of base pair rules, too. They're what? AT and GC. All right, and what's the general structure of DNA? Is it single-stranded or double-stranded? It's going to be double-stranded. All right, so you can tell if something is DNA or RNA or a protein by looking at the bases that are there, by the structure, if it's single-stranded or double-stranded. So if I just had maybe a single strand of DNA with these bases right here, C, A, T, C, Could you tell me if that was DNA or RNA? If I just had this one single strand, not the double strand, but this single strand, could you tell me that was DNA? Absolutely. Why is that? Because you got a thymine right here. In RNA, you don't have thymine. You have uracil, right? So you have AUGC base pairing rules for RNA. All right, so those are some ways that you can check. But a real easy way you can tell this is DNA is why? Double-stranded, right? So that confirms your impression that this is DNA because there's a thymine right there. All right, so going, so this double-stranded DNA has to unzip and it's got to unwind to form this nice linear molecule right here. And this is going to be used to as a template to make some messenger RNA. So what do we use? What do we call this process of taking information in DNA and converting it into information in RNA? What's that step? That's transcription, right? And it probably, oh, it says it on the slide right here. Where does that happen? In the nucleus. All right, so here's a thymine. That's going to base pair with adenine. So we're making a messenger RNA right here. And we said last time we looked at the universal genetic code, how many bases does it require to define one amino acid in the growing protein? Three bases, right? So here we see one, two, three. This sequence of bases in a messenger RNA is called a codon. That's a codon. And after this messenger RNA is made, it's going to unzip from the DNA molecule, be exported into the cytoplasm, and a ribosome is going to use it to put in, all right, to add amino acids together just in this correct sequence that's defined by this sequence of codons right here. So a good question maybe on an exam is, what kind of RNA molecule has codons on it? The messenger RNA has codons. And how would you be able to, what do you need to build a protein from a sequence of codons in messenger RNA? How do you know which amino acid goes where? What would you use? Okay, base pairing rules, I suppose, but this is what you're going to use. What? The universal genetic code. So if you have an AUG codon, that's going to, you're going to find that at the end of the messenger RNA, but if you have a UCC, then a serine is going to be placed at that particular location where that codon exists within the messenger RNA. Okay, so here is your protein, methionine, glycine, serine. And for serine, I tell you what is the, what's the genetic code, universal genetic code for serine? You can see it right here, UCC. And what's the most amazing thing about that? It's not just you and your cousins use that genetic code, or you and me and all the other humans on the planet, but what? Everything that's alive that makes proteins uses that same universal genetic code. Maybe with a few little modifications someplace. All right, so using a sequence of codons, which is what, really a sequence of nucleotides in messenger RNA, when that's used to make a protein, what do we call that process? Translation. Why do you call that translation? Yeah, you're changing one language, which, how would you describe the first language? You could say it's a language based on nucleotides into a language that's based on amino acids, right? So that's translation, right? So, but you have the code. You can go back and forth. Now, what about in your body? Can your body go back and forth? No, right? Remember the central dogma, that's a one-way street. Proteins in your body can't go backwards to direct RNA synthesis or direct the synthesis of DNA. Right, it's just that one-way street. You can go back and look at that slide. All right, there's one last RNA that we want to look at. It looks something like this, right? Kind of looks like a big X. And generally, RNA has difficulty forming double strands because of that oxygen that's in that position on ribose. But nonetheless, there can be short segments where it can base pair with each other. It can form some strands can come together a little bit. And one end of the molecule is a place where an amino acid can be joined to it, and the other end of a transfer RNA has an anticodon. And the anticodon is going to match up with the codon so that base pairing rules are maintained. Right, so a transfer RNA can bind to this part of the messenger RNA, which is GGC, if the transfer RNA has what sequence of nucleotides on it? It's got to be C, C, G, right? So if there's a CCG on this anticodon right here, right, then this transfer RNA can bring in this amino acid right at that one particular location. All right. Well, if we have a UUA, what is UUA going to bind to in messenger RNA? It's going to be AAU. Do we have an AAU in the previous example? I haven't looked. AAU. We don't have an AAU anywhere. All right. So it won't fit in any of these places. So it won't bring that particular amino acid onto this growing protein. Okay. So on the messenger RNA, we have codons. And then on the transfer RNA, we have the complementary base pairs that we call anticodons. All right, so that's how transfer RNA can match up with the messenger RNAs. And this is a pretty good example picture that you have in your book. All right, we got the messenger RNA, which tells your body how to spell out a particular protein in terms of amino acid sequence. All right, so these things, each sequence of three is what we call a codon in messenger RNA. Okay, and codons can base pair with anticodons that we have on a transfer RNA. So don't forget, it's the job of this transfer RNA to bring amino acids to this workbench. All right, what is this workbench made out of? Ribosomal RNA and some proteins, right? So here's the workbench for what kind of process? Okay, yeah, if you said protein synthesis, that's pretty good, but what step of protein synthesis? Yeah, translation, because that's in the cytoplasm. All right, so transfer RNA is going to bind, right? So here's a codon on the messenger RNA, here's the anticodon on a transfer RNA. It's going to slip into the ribosome, and the transfer RNA is bringing an amino acid, and when it does, a peptide bond is going to form right here. So now we've just added an amino acid to this growing protein chain right here. Okay, and then once this bond is made, the ribosome is going to move up to reveal another codon, right? In which case, another transfer RNA is going to bring in another amino acid. It's going to base pair properly because of the base pairing rules. And then another peptide bond is going to form between amino acid number 5 and number 6, right? And when that's done, guess what the ribosome does? Moves up to the next location, right? And then moves up to the next location, adding amino acids until it sees the stop sign, in which case then the ribosome is going to break apart, dissociate, go off of the messenger RNA, and that process can start all over again. What's the stop sign? What is the codon for stop? What would you use to find out what the codon for stop is? Yeah, the universal genetic code, and you see that. What's the stop sign? UAG, right? So that's going to be termination. That's going to signal termination of translation, and then that complete protein is made. Okay. So here you can see a number of ribosomes that are attached to the endoplasmic reticulum, and the ribosomes are attached right around this little pore so that as the messenger RNA moves through the ribosome right here, the protein ends up inside the cisternae of the endoplasmic reticulum, and then its fate is sealed to be secreted outside the cell, right? But if this is a free ribosome, this protein is going to end up in the cytoplasm someplace, right? Or in the cytosol, okay? All right. So this is a pretty good slide right here for you to say, well, which one of these sequences right here, is this DNA or RNA? So if you look at just this top row right here, is this DNA or RNA without reading? That's DNA because there's a thymine, right? And what about this bottom row right here? That's RNA because you see uracils, right? And so going from DNA to RNA's transcription and then from RNA to protein, that's translation. And you need that ribosome in order for that to happen. Another thing you should be aware of is where do we find the codons? What molecule contains codons? The messenger RNA. And what kind of RNA has anticodons? The transfer RNA, right? And they come together because of the proper base pairing rules. Okay. So who's got a question on that? Anybody got a question on that? Your book does a pretty good job of talking about that. One last process that we want to talk about is DNA replication. All right, so what does DNA replication mean? So if I go DNA to RNA, what's that? What is DNA going to making more DNA? What the heck is that? So what's this first process called? Yeah, transcription. And the second process right here is called replication, DNA replication. All right, so don't forget how important DNA is. It's a set of instructions on how to build your body, right? But don't forget there's a relationship between structure and function. If you build your body in the right form, the right structure, it's going to have the right function. So DNA also controls the function of your body because it defines the structure. All right, so DNA has to replicate itself, all right, before mitosis can take place. What the heck is mitosis? What is mitosis? Starting with a parent cell. Anybody know how many chromosomes are in a normal somatic cell of your body? Yeah, there's 46. All right, and so what the heck is mitosis? Study that a lot in anatomy. It's when the cell is going to divide, right? It's going to split, and now you're going to have two kinds of what kind of cells? Daughter cells. What's the difference between these daughter cells? Nothing. They should be exactly equal to each other, and they should be exactly equal to this parent cell right here. So how many chromosomes are going to be in this nucleus of this daughter cell? 46. And how many here? 46. Well, how can it be if you start with 46 and you split them in half, you end up with 2 times 46. You got 46 in here and 46 in here. Well, because in this, before mitosis can take place, remember there's a phase called interphase, right? And during interphase, you have DNA replication. So these chromosomes in here are replicated. So in fact, you really have like 92 chromosomes before mitosis takes place. All right, we're going to talk about mitosis just a little bit. So how does replication take place? We didn't talk about this in anatomy. Okay. Well, let me go back to this slide right here. So the enzyme that is necessary to use DNA, the sequence of DNA, this is a polymer of deoxyribonucleotides. There is an enzyme that can take this sequence of deoxyribonucleotides and make a sequence of ribonucleotides. This is another polymer. We call that RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase, because it's making a polymer of RNA. All right. There is another kind of polymerase. It's called a DNA polymerase. So it makes a sequence of deoxyribonucleotides, but it doesn't make RNA. What's it going to make? It's going to make DNA. So we call it a DNA polymerase. Kind of similar to RNA polymerase. So first, there has to be an enzyme that breaks the hydrogen bonds of the double-stranded DNA, right? And then unwinds the DNA. We call that a helicase. Right, then the DNA polymerase can bind to each strand of the DNA, and then it's going to use each strand as a template to make more DNA. And the way that it makes it, we say that it is semi-conservative. And here are the base pairing rules that you're familiar with, right? ATGC. Right? So the original DNA sequence is preserved. So here's a nice graphic that I want you to be aware of. So here is the original DNA molecule, right? And you can, and how do you know this is DNA? Double-stranded, you got thymines in there, okay? And so before DNA replication can take place, right, the helicase has to break these hydrogen bonds, and it's got to unwind the molecule to reveal these bases to the cytoplasm. And when it does, and the DNA polymerase can bind, and it's going to start adding deoxyribonucleotides according to the base pair rule. So what's going to base pair with, let's start with this A right here, because that's the first one. That's going to be a thymine, because what are we making? We're not making RNA, we're making more DNA, right? So thymine is going to join right here, and then with this G, cytosine is going to base pair. So that's the job of the DNA polymerase, is to make this strand. notice there's a difference in color. This is really dark, and this is a lot lighter. Right? And if we trace this lighter molecule up, what is it? It is the original, it's half of the original DNA molecule, half of that double-stranded molecule. Right? So this strand right here is acting as a template to make a completely new strand. Now let's look at the other side. Here is the old strand, and then here is another new strand that's being made. But in this case too, right, the old strand is acting as a template to make the new strand. And because you have a template right here, what can you tell me about the DNA down over here compared to the original DNA that was down over here? It's exactly the same, right? So if you wanted to make a shirt and you want to make 100 copies of that shirt all exactly the same, what would you use? You'd use a template or a pattern, right? You could just cut out the same patterns over and over again and you would have exact copies. Right, and the reason why we call this semi-conservative is because after DNA replication takes place, both new strands are half of the old and half of the new. All right, so it's semi-conservative. As opposed to completely conservative would mean what? You would have two of the old in one chromosome. But that's not how chromosomes are made, by DNA replication. Who's got a question on DNA replication? So be familiar with that concept of template, know what a helicase is all about, and what semi-conservative means. What does semi-conservative mean? So that the new DNA is half old, half new strand, right? And don't forget, DNA is double-stranded, so you got two. One is old, and the other is the new one. And it's copied with high fidelity because the old strand is always used as a template to make the new strand according to the base pairing rules. All right, cell cycle you're really familiar with already, I'm sure. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with the cell cycle, but don't forget the two reasons for mitosis. I don't think we have it on any of these slides. Why do we have this process right here going on in our bodies? What are the two reasons for mitosis? Somebody said something I like. Okay. Some people will say, well, reproduction. Well, not really, because mitosis is reproduction. You can't use a word in its own definition. Right? So the reason for mitosis is because at one point in time, okay, you had a sperm from your dad and an egg from your mom come together to form you. All right? And got interrupted. So what do we call that single cell? Well, what do you call that process when an egg and a sperm come together to form you? That's fertilization, right? And so the okay. And so what is that single cell called? That's a zygote. Probably have to take a biology class, right, to really understand that. But it's okay if you hear that term. You are a zygote. But that's not very interesting state of existence, because if you're still a zygote, you couldn't be in a physiology class taking notes or go to physiology lab and do experiments or anything like that, right? So you have to get big, which is a good movie. So how do you get big? By mitosis, right? We call that growth. So one reason for mitosis is growth. To go from a unicellular organism to an organism that has trillions of cells, like you do right now. Which is much more interesting. The second purpose is not all of the cells that you have today were the ones that you had 5 years ago. As a matter of fact, you have very few of those cells left, especially, for instance, red blood cells. How long do red blood cells live in your body? Some people might know. Okay? Only about 120 days, and then they die because they don't have a nucleus. Right? They can't repair themselves. They can't undergo protein synthesis, new protein synthesis, because there's no DNA to direct that process. So whenever they get challenged, they just kind of give up. So does anybody know how many red blood cells you lose in your body every second? Oh, yeah, we can say 2 million. Maybe 1.5 to 2 million red blood cells every second die, right? Because they're just not made to live a long time. So what do you call that condition when you start to deplete your body of red blood cells? You run out of red blood cells. What do we call that? Oh, I think I heard it over here someplace. That's called anemia, right? That's anemia. So in order to prevent yourself from going, from becoming anemic, what does your body have to do? It has to replace those cells. How many cells? About 2 million every second. So that's, you're really busy making red blood cells and making all kinds of cells in your body all the time. By what kind of process? Mitosis, right? So we can say here, replace old or what? Damaged cells. That's another important reason, right? So those are two reasons for mitosis, for growth and to replace old and damaged cells. So I always want you to really understand not just the mechanisms of everything, but why it's important in our bodies. All right, so interphase is not a phase where the cell is dividing. It's not an active phase of mitosis. It's really what? It's a growth phase where chromosomes are being replicated, where mitochondria replicate themselves, where different organelles replicate themselves, like centrioles. Because when the cytoplasm splits, you don't want all the centrioles, two centrioles in one cell and none in the other, right? You want two and two. So interphase is a growth phase. And that's what we see on this slide right here. So here is interphase, which has a G1 and an S and a G2 phase. G1 is just a normal phase of the life cycle of the cell where it undergoes its normal physiologic processes. Maybe it's an endocrine cell going to be secreting hormones. This is the phase in which it does that. So this might be the longest phase that the cell exists in. And then when it's time to undergo mitosis, right, DNA has to be replicated. It goes into the S phase of interphase. And then G2 is the final phase where the cell gets ready for mitosis, right? So chromatin condenses prior to cell division, right? This is where you begin to see some chromosomes forming. And then mitosis actually starts with prophase, right? Goes to metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. And here's a little nice illustration that shows you can see these chromosomes. And this little X right here represents this guy, all right? So this is a replicated chromosome. So here might be one chromosome, and here is the other one after it has been replicated. And don't forget, one strand is old and the other is new, right? But you have two copies of it connected at the centromere. We still call this just one replicated chromosome or duplicated chromosome, right? So we don't really consider that this cell has 92 because they're connected at the centromere. All right, and these are considered sister chromatids, right? These are chromatids. The ends are what we call a telomere, right? So when you see hear that term telo, you should think of what? The end of something, right? Could be a structure or it could be an end of a process. All right, so here are the four phases. You got to know the proper sequence of these phases. What little acronym can you say to remember the phases? Like IPMAT, for instance, right? Interphase, prophase, IP, MAT, what's next? Metaphase, right? Anaphase, telophase. All right, so you should know some characteristics of each of these phases right here. And maybe, I don't know if this is an exam figure. Does anybody have their study guide out? Are these exam figures? Yeah, they are. Good. Well, they were in anatomy. I can't remember if they are for physiology or not. Yeah, so you should know that during prophase, condensation of the extended chromatin condenses into chromosomes, the nuclear envelope starts to disappear, the spindle apparatus begins to form, and maybe even the nuclear envelope disappears completely like you see right here. So that's prophase. And you know this is not anaphase because all these chromosomes are just have a random appearance where the nucleus was, right? They're not ordered in any kind of fashion. Metaphase, the chromosomes line up exactly on the equator of the cell. During anaphase, the sister chromatids start to separate, being pulled apart by the spindle apparatus, and they become then daughter chromatids. The chromosomes attach to the spindle apparatus at the centromere, right? And the pieces of that centromere, sometimes we call the kinetochore, you might be familiar with. I get some questions about that all the time. And then the last phase we call telophase, which is characterized by cytokinesis. So what the heck is cytokinesis? It's when a cleavage furrow develops within the center, right on the equator of the parent cell, and it splits the parent cell into two daughter cells, thereby separating the cytoplasm into two separate cells. So one way maybe you could think of mitosis is the separation of DNA into two daughter cells, right, with all those proper phases. Cytokinesis, on the other hand, is really the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. So that might be a nice way to think about mitosis versus cytokinesis. Okay, I think maybe that's all I'm going to talk about in this chapter. We might go back to meiosis, maybe not. Okay. So if that was fast with mitosis, just go back to your anatomy and look at some of your anatomy discussions. All right, so I know that was fast. All right, so now we're going to move into chapter 6. Okay, and chapter 6 is going to be our last chapter before the test. All right, so everything we've covered today, up to today, but including chapter 6, will be on the first test, which is scheduled for February 16th. That's a Monday. That is a Tuesday. Thank you. All right, so that's a Tuesday, but it's not Tuesday of next week. It's Tuesday of the week after. Okay? All right, so kind of be aware of that. So what the heck is this chapter right here? Oh, here's some physical chemistry in this chapter, which I think is what you guys were doing in lab. Okay. All right, so interactions between cells and the extracellular environment. So this is a way that cells can communicate with each other and how things move across the membrane transport. So we consider that membrane transport. So we got to be considered with diffusion and osmosis. All right, so a good place to start with this is that all of the living processes take place in a solution. So let's define what a solution is. What's a solution and the components of a solution? All right, it's not like a solution to a problem. A solution is got two components. It's got a fluid part, and then it's got junk dissolved in the fluid. All right, so the fluid part is what we call the solvent. I don't know if you went over this in lab yet or not. It doesn't sound like it. Solvent. All right. And the solid particles that are dissolved in the solvent are called the solute. All right. So a solution has those two parts. And you might be wondering, well, why is one sometimes called the solvent and why the solute? Well, the solvent is usually the majority molecule. Like you could put two liquids together, like alcohol and water. All right. They're both liquids. And if you have more alcohol than water, then what is the solvent? If you have more alcohol than water, what's going to be the solvent? It's going to be alcohol. But if you have more water than alcohol, then water is the solvent. Okay, so it's just by majority that we define these terms. All right, so these different body compartments are solutions, right? And the solvent is going to be water in every case. Okay. So the intracellular compartment, which is makes about 67% of the total body, okay, is inside cells. The extracellular compartment, sometimes we call that the extracellular fluid, 33% is outside of the cells. And of this percentage right here, so most of the water is where? Intracellular, right? About a third is outside the cells. And of the extracellular compartment right here, okay, 80% is in interstitial fluid, which is the fluid between cells, and the remainder is extracellular fluid that makes up plasma, blood plasma, right? So we have these three compartments that we're going to be looking at all the time. The extracellular matrix, where do we have a matrix? What kind of tissue has a matrix? Yeah, like connective tissue. right? So here we see an epithelium, basement membrane. Here is some underlying connective tissue. And in the matrix right here, we have fibers, but we also have glycoproteins and proteoglycans that kind of acts like a sponge that makes up a substance we call ground substance, right? So the ground substance acts like a sponge holding onto water. So fluid will leave plasma, go into the interstitial space, spend some time over here, and at the other end of the capillary, it will be resorbed. So there's like a little flow pattern right here. The water will flow through the ground substance. And then it will, bring nutrients to all the cells that are in that tissue. All right, so let's talk about transport across a plasma membrane. So plasma membrane, we say, is selectively permeable. What is the basic structure of a simple membrane? How would you describe the internal structure of all membranes in the body? A phospholipid bilayer, right? All right, so here we have a phospholipid bilayer, and what am I drawing right here? The polar head groups, right? So here is the polar head groups on the other side, and then poking up into the membrane right here are the hydrophobic tails of these phospholipids right here. And so this is hydrophilic area. Right here is hydrophobic. And if we have a molecule that is hydrophilic, like a sodium ion, it can't get through the membrane because it can't get through this hydrophobic region right here, right? Because that's a polar molecule, this is a nonpolar region, so it can't get through. So this membrane might allow some molecules to move through because there might be a little channel right here that allows water to go through it, okay, but not sodium. Sodium can't fit through this channel. All right, so this membrane will allow some things to go through but not others. We call that a selectively permeable, or we could say it is semi-permeable. Semi-permeable and selectively permeable are the same thing. And that's mostly due to this hydrophobic region. All right, so if you do have molecules that are polar, they need either channels to go through the membrane or actual molecules, right, that we call transporters. And I'll show you some pictures of transporters which allow molecules, the polar molecules, to move across the membrane. On the other hand, hydrophobic molecules can move right across the membrane. So what kind of molecule do you know? What kind of molecules do you know that are hydrophobic? That is their nature. Lipids. Give me an example of some lipids. Like fatty acids, okay? Cholesterol is one that I'm really thinking of, all right? And cholesterol is used to make what kind of compounds? Some signaling compounds in your body, namely steroids, right? So steroids, what can you tell me about a steroid? It can move right through the plasma membrane because it can get through this hydrophobic region, right? And steroids are important hormones, and their action is inside the cell because they can actually enter the cell, right? Other kinds of signaling molecules can't get in, so they have to have a receptor on the plasma membrane. Steroids have receptors in the cytoplasm or even in the nucleus. They don't need a transporter. All right, so here are some ways that molecules can move across the plasma membrane. Some by carrier-mediated transport. That involves a specific protein transporter, right? Versus non-carrier-mediated transport occurs by diffusion through holes in the membrane, special channels, and these channels are made out of proteins. Right, so those are two ways. Here's another way to think of membrane transport. And that is, well, I'm going to leave that little diagram right there. And that is whether the process is active or passive. All right, so active mean versus passive. Active means that you need some energy in order for it to happen. What's a universal energy form in your body? ATP, right? So if it's active, it needs ATP. And if it's passive, the process happens all by itself, automatically, right? So no ATP is required. And let's talk about how this happens according to a concentration gradient. So here we have a beaker with a couple solute molecules in it, and then here we got another beaker, all right, with some solute molecules in here, A, B. Which beaker has a higher concentration of solute? B, right? It has a higher concentration, okay? This has a lower concentration. And if we take away that little division, okay, in one part of this beaker now, you have a low concentration. Another part, we have a high concentration. So now there is not a uniform distribution of solute. That's a concentration gradient, right? There's a difference in concentration. Okay. All right, for active transport, all right, think of, I have this hill right here. Okay, so I have a hill. When I was in college, I had, I think, a 1962 MGB, which is a really cool car, okay? But it hardly ever worked, okay? I couldn't always get it started. Sometimes the starter motor was broken. Sometimes the battery was dead. All kinds of different reasons. The wire would come off someplace, right? So I couldn't start my car. But the car was about as big as this desk right here, and it had a clutch, a manual transmission, so to get it started, you could just push it, pop the clutch, and that would turn the engine over. I didn't need the starter motor or the battery. So where would I park my car all the time? I would park it on a hill. Okay? Maybe you parked your car on a hill somewhere around here this morning. Okay? Well, what can you tell me about this car? I could just stick my left foot out the door, get it started, and would it roll down the hill all by itself? Absolutely. Okay? Because what kind of process is that? That's a passive process, right? Now, if we have my car down over here, if I want to go up the hill, all right, so this is passive, all right, what is this top process? This is active, all right, what do we need for that to happen? Yeah, we need energy, gasoline. I don't know any cars that run on ATP, but that would be cool if there were, okay? So active means that in terms of solute molecules, in order to go from low to high, right, going from low concentration to high, what do you need? You need ATP, okay? But if you're at high concentration going to low, that will happen all by itself. You don't need ATP, all right? So in order for these molecules to move, going, so here we have low, and here we have high, right here. So if these molecules over here, if these solute molecules are over here and they move to over here going from high to low, how is that going to happen, active or passive? That's going to be a passive process. That will just happen all by itself. But to take these molecules that are at low concentration and put them over here, what do you need? You need energy to do that. That won't happen automatically, right? So you might want to think about my car, right? So just think, high to low, passive. Okay, and low to high going the other way, that's going to require energy in order for that to happen. In terms of this solution right here, when these molecules move according to their concentration gradient, we call that diffusion. All right, so if a molecule moves from high concentration to low down its concentration gradient, we call that diffusion. So the gradient has to be there in order for diffusion to work. Another example of diffusion, okay, if I have a perfume bottle right here and I open it up, the perfume is going to dissolve in the air, and let's just say there's no perfume anywhere else in the room, right, even though there's no fans blowing the air around in here, what's going to happen to these perfume molecules right here? They're going to move through the whole room, right? First people in the front row is going to smell it, then next row, and then finally in the back, right? So because there's a huge concentration gradient, high right here, low in the back of the room. Right, so these molecules will move. Now, if we close the door and leave that bottle open all night long, okay, and come back in the morning, we're going to have the same concentration of perfume in the back as in the front, because it's going to what? Diffuse. What happens to diffusion when the concentration in the back is the same as the front? Are these molecules going to move anymore? No. Diffusion stops, right? And so you look at some of that in lab. So if there's no concentration gradient, no diffusion can take place. All right, now is it possible to take all that perfume that's in the room and stick it back in the bottle, going from low concentration in the room to high concentration in the bottle? Okay? And some people said no. Well, I want you to think about, well, how did all that perfume get in the bottle if there's no way to do that? There is a way to take perfume that's in the room, put it back in the bottle, going from low concentration to high, but what do you need? Yeah, you need some kind of energy. You need some kind of process that requires energy. You got to have a machine, plug it into the wall, right, and it's going to take perfume and concentrate it for you. So it's possible, but you need energy to get it to go the reverse direction, okay, because your body has to do that too, but it's going to cost you. And you, what's it going to cost you? ATP, okay? All right, so you can move things against the concentration gradient, but that requires energy and actual transporters in the membrane. Oh, I have this equation right here. Okay, so what's a solution? Here we go. Solution is a solvent and a solute. Have you used a solvent today for anything? Yes, like what?
Coffee.
Yeah, coffee. Perfect example. So what would be the solvent? And the solute would be? Yeah, the coffee particles, maybe put cream in there or sugar or whatever, right? So those would be the solutes. So what solutes have you used today? You don't have to tell me. Okay, that could be your little secret, but we just talked about that. Okay. What's the major solvent in your body?
Water.
It's water. Now, you do have a couple places where water is not the solvent. An oil actually is the solvent. And where is that? Really funny solution. And we don't talk a lot about this in medicine and physiology, but you know what? In years to come, I'm sure it's going to be. Where do we have a different solvent system in our body? Right inside the membrane. That's not a water solution, right? This is like a lipid solution. So things that can dissolve in lipids will exist in this solution. Things that are polar will exist in your water compartments. So we just looked at the three water compartments. All right, so what are some important solutes in your body?
Calcium ions,
yes, I mentioned that. Sodium ions. What about glucose? Yeah, absolutely. So all those things are nice hydrophilic polar compounds that dissolve in water. Here's a good question. I guess I answered this one already. What's a minor solvent in your body? That's a solute. Magnesium would be a solute. So the solvent is something that things can dissolve in. Okay, so a minor solvent, which means you don't have a lot of, is what? The membranes, the phospholipid, is in particular this lipid area right inside the membrane. That can act like a solution, but only for hydrophobic kinds of compounds. All right, so what can dissolve in this minor solvent? What can dissolve inside the plasma membrane? Yeah, like steroids or other kinds of hydrophobic compounds, right? Any kind of lipid molecules. And a good example, for instance, would be a steroid molecule. Okay. All right, so I think we talked about diffusion already. Here we see these little dots represent what? Solute. And here we have a high concentration. Here we have a low concentration. These will move from left to right due to concentration gradient, but over a long period of time, as it becomes equal, then no diffusion will take place, right? So diffusion is the driving force for moving down a concentration gradient. And don't forget, is that active or passive? That's absolutely passive, right? Diffusion is always going to be passive. All right, so nonpolar compounds can diffuse through the cell membrane if they're small enough. Oh no, nonpolar, meaning not like water. Things that are even big, like steroid molecules, can move through the plasma membrane. But some small molecules, okay, can get through there as well. And gas exchange takes place just this way, because oxygen and CO2 are very, very small molecules. And of course, cells in our body require oxygen. Well, it's an organelle that requires oxygen. I think I mentioned this. Mitochondria, in order to make ATP, they require oxygen. All right, so how does oxygen get into these cells right here? Is it an active process or a passive process? Active or passive? Our cells are desperate for oxygen, right? We would die without it very quickly. Matter of seconds, right, if we don't have oxygen. So how does oxygen get in those cells? You should be worried about that, right? Because you only have seconds to live without oxygen. Okay, and the way that that happens is that it happens by diffusion, a passive process. So what does that mean? Low to high or high to low? High to low. So in order for oxygen to enter our bodies, what's the concentration of oxygen in our cells? Is it high or low? It's got to be low, because if it's high compared to other places, it would leave your body. So concentration of oxygen in our cells is low, but in the atmosphere, it's what? It's high. It's very high. So oxygen moves by diffusion from a high concentration in the air down into cells where there's low concentration. And it's kind of maintained at a low concentration. Why is it maintained low? Why does it stay lower inside the cell? Because remember, as the concentration equalizes, diffusion stops. Why is oxygen always low inside cells? Because it's used up. Mitochondria use it up to make ATP. Right, and as it's used up, then more oxygen can enter the cells because there's a concentration gradient. But there's another compound that builds up inside our cells, and that is the reason why you exhale, and that is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide, does that move by passive or active process out of your body? And again, it's just a passive process. You don't require ATP to move all that carbon dioxide out. Your cells are producing carbon dioxide, so it's at high concentration inside the cell, and the concentration of CO2 in the air is, well, it's basically zero. So it's a huge gradient. So CO2 loves to leave your body because there's almost no CO2 in the air around us. Right? So if it goes from high to low, from inside our cells to outside, that's just a passive process. That's diffusion. Okay. All right, so here is an example of a nice phospholipid bilayer that has got some proteins, transmembrane proteins in it. And this is a channel. And more importantly, this is a fancy channel because it can open and it can close. And if there's a channel that can open and close, depending on something could be telling it to open or close, right? We call that a gate. So a pore is just a channel that's open all the time, but if it can open and close, we call it a gated channel. It can open and close. So sometimes this molecule, all right, we're going to say that these are just ions right here. Ions cannot get across a plasma membrane because the membrane is, quote unquote, what kind of permeability does it have? It's selectively permeable, and it's selectively permeable because of this hydrophobic region right here. And these are all polar compounds, right? Ions have electrical charge on them, makes them polar, can't get through the plasma membrane. So they need a channel. When the channel is open, when the gate is open, these ions can move. Now, which way are these ions going to move? High concentration to low, right? By diffusion. They're just going to move by diffusion. And when the gate closes, they can't move, even though there is a concentration gradient, because they can't get through the membrane. All right, so charged particles or molecules must have an ion channel or a transporter to move across the membrane. But not just charged molecules, probably I want to say what? Any kind of polar compound. Now, what about glucose? What can you tell me about glucose? What kind of saccharide is that? This is a review just for the test. What kind of? It's a monosaccharide. Okay. And is glucose a polar compound or nonpolar? And how on earth would you figure that out? It's polar. Well, you know glucose is polar. You know sugars are polar because you used it as a solute this morning. Maybe you put it in your coffee, for instance. All right, now why does it dissolve into solution? Because it has all of those. It's got a carbon, right, which makes it nonpolar, but what's coming off the carbons? Remember, it's called a carbohydrate, carbon with water. You got a H. What else are we missing for water? OH, right? H2O. So here's one, and then we got another one over here. So here you got an oxygen bound to a hydrogen. This oxygen here is highly electronegative, which makes what? This a a very polar bond. So it's pulling the electron away from the hydrogen, bringing it into the oxygen, and it gives this area here a little positive charge, which makes it go into solution very easily. All right, so polysaccharides have a lot of these OH groups, which makes them very polar compounds. So can glucose enter a cell by itself? Can it get through this hydrophobic region right here? Glucose is stuck outside the cell. Now, you might be a little bit worried about that because cells need glucose to stay alive. Cells need glucose, or mitochondria need glucose to make ATP. That's the fuel source for making ATP along with oxygen. But if glucose can't get into the cell, that cell is going to starve to death. Right? So we're interested in knowing in this class how glucose gets in there. Some people have big problems with that because they don't have the proper transporters, or they don't have the proper signals in their body to put those transporters in the membrane. What's that disease process called when you can't absorb, when your cells can't absorb glucose? It's called diabetes. And when your cells don't absorb glucose, where does that glucose stay? It gets trapped. It gets trapped in the blood. So blood glucose remains really high, even though that glucose is just right on the other side of that plasma membrane. Those cells are going to starve to death because they can't get through right here when somebody has diabetes mellitus. That's the importance of these transporters. Okay, so diffusion is directly related to a couple of things. And I think maybe you're doing this in lab this week. Okay, so it's directly related to the concentration gradient of the solutes. So if the concentration gradient goes up, what happens to the rate of diffusion? If it's directly related, it goes up, right? The concentration gradient gets big, the rate goes up big as well. As the concentration gradient goes down, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It goes down because they are directly related to each other, right? It's also directly related to the permeability of the membrane. If there's no pathway for that particular molecule to move across the membrane, then it can't move, even though there's a concentration gradient. There's got to be a channel or a pore. All right, what about temperature? It's directly related. So that means if the temperature goes up, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It goes up as well. Because what temperature is, did you talk about what temperature really means? It's a measure of how fast molecules are moving around. Right? How fast they're vibrating, spinning, or whatever. It's just directly related to their motion. So as the temperature increases, everything gets just mixed faster, so diffusion can happen faster. And then, diffusion is also proportional or directly related to the surface area of the membrane. So if it's a big doorway, a lot of molecules can move back and forth. If it's a really small doorway, then not very many molecules can move back and forth across the membrane. So surface area, all right, I want you to think of that as a doorway. What's the surface area of this piece of paper? Yeah, it would be, what, 8.5 times 11 inches, and you could calculate the surface area in square inches right here. So that's what we mean by surface area. In terms of people moving through a doorway with this surface area compared to a surface area of that door over there, which one could more people move through at one time? Yeah, because it's bigger, right? It's directly related to the surface area. Same thing for cells. All right, but there's something where that controls diffusion in the inverse way, which means as this parameter increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It goes down because it's inversely related. And that is molecular weight. That's just the weight or the size of the molecule. As a molecule gets bigger, right, then the rate of diffusion decreases. And that's pretty easy to remember because I suppose you could think of my car, but I got a better example. Say you're on Valley View going home tonight and you have that semi-tractor trailer, all right, right at the stoplight, okay, and you'd like to be behind them at a stoplight? No, because it takes them a while to get going. But here's even a better example. You got a semi-tractor trailer and a motorcycle. Okay, which one is going to get through the intersection first? Motorcycle, because its molecular weight, right, is a lot less than that big truck. It's going to be able to accelerate and get through the intersection. So as the molecule gets bigger, it slows down. Okay, the rate of diffusion decreases. All right, so that takes us to osmosis. So diffusion could be due to any of these compounds right here. If we have a solution, all right, so what's a solution again? Solvent and solute. Diffusion can pertain to either one of these species right here, as long as it's going what? From high concentration to low. And it doesn't have to be in a biological system. It can be in this room, for instance. Osmosis is a special term. And we're going to use this equation to understand some of the distinctions between osmosis and diffusion itself, diffusion. Okay, there are some special criteria that make osmosis different from diffusion. Just simple diffusion. All right, the thing about osmosis, so we want to talk about osmosis right here. The first thing is that it is diffusion. Now, what can you tell me about diffusion? It's passive. It also means high to low. All right, so that's the first criteria for osmosis. It has to be diffusion. If there are molecules that are going from low to high, cannot be osmosis. All right, so that's the first criteria. So that's kind of a loaded term, right? Because you got to know what diffusion really means. The second thing for osmosis is that it's got to be only the solvent molecule. Only a solvent molecule, by definition, can osmose. And what's the solvent in you? Water. All right, so for biological systems, osmosis necessarily means only the water molecule, not any of the solutes, like glucose or sodium, potassium. Those things can't osmose. Now, in chemistry, you might use other kinds of solvents. You might use chloroform, okay? Chloroform, if it's the solvent, then you could think of osmosis, right? But not for biology. The third criteria is, for osmosis, there has to be a membrane involved, and a very special kind of membrane. What kind of membranes have we been talking about? Selectively permeable or semi-permeable. There has to be a semi-permeable membrane. All right, a semi-permeable membrane. That's osmosis. So those are the three criteria, and you can see them right up there. All right, so if you got a molecule moving from high to low, and that molecule is water, but there's no membrane involved, can that be osmosis? No, that's just diffusion, right? Okay, so it's got to have all of these things. Okay, so an example of osmosis. All right, so it's the net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. That's what I've said already. Water means that, since it's diffusion, it has to move down a concentration gradient. It's got to go from high to low concentration. All right, so it's got to go from water, or so water is less concentrated where there are more solutes. So let's look at this system right here, this box. So we got the left and the right-hand side. Where is water more concentrated? It's on the left because you have less solute, so you have more water over here than over here. All right, so less water concentration here, more water concentration over here because you got more solutes over here. Okay. Now, in order for this to be osmosis, we got to have a membrane. So here's a membrane. But what else about this membrane can you tell me? It's got to be selectively permeable, right? So there are pores in this membrane that are small that allow a water molecule to move through, but these pores are too small to allow these big solute molecules to move through. So these solutes over here are trapped, right? But water is not. So what's going to happen to water? Water is going to move by diffusion until you have the same concentration of water on both sides of the membrane. So water is going to move from left to right in this particular case. All right, and so since water is going to move, but the solute is not, we're going to say that these solutes are osmotically active. Just the fact that you have a high concentration of solute over here on the right compared to the left, that means that water is going to be driven from the left-hand side into the right-hand side. So these impermeable solutes are what we say osmotically active, because they can't move across the membrane right here. All right, so water diffuses down its concentration gradient until both sides have the same concentration. And if this membrane can slide back and forth, notice that it's going to slide over to the left as water moves into the right-hand side. So now you have the same concentration of solute on either side. Well, let's start with this. So I didn't define what the concentrations are. So on the left-hand side, we have about 180 grams per liter of glucose, right? And on the right-hand side, it's double that. All right, so the water concentration is half on the right-hand side. All right, and then we start the clock ticking, and water moves from left to right, equalizing the concentration on both sides. And so now the volume of the right-hand side has to be bigger than the volume on the left-hand side. Okay, and what can you tell me about the concentration of glucose on both sides of the membrane? It's going to be the same. And when it's the same, what happens to the movement of water? It's going to stop. Right? Some cells that have these channels for water in the membrane, okay, those channels are what we call aquaporins. They're pores for water, water pores. A good example of a tissue that has water pores would be a kidney, for instance. We'll look at those later on. All right, so osmotic pressure is the pressure that can develop when you have a selectively permeable membrane and a difference in concentration of this solvent on either side of the membrane. All right, so where were we? We were here. We moved the membrane over to the left due to osmosis. Right? But what we can do is we can push the membrane back to its original location. Right? But that's going to require force to do that. And the amount of force that is required to move this membrane back to its original position right here is called osmotic pressure. All right, so just by having a difference in concentration of water, that produces a pressure on this membrane. Okay? And in this case right here, it's going to cause this compartment to get bigger. Right, and you can measure it by pushing the membrane back to where it was. That's what we call osmotic pressure, or the force that's necessary to prevent a volume change. And what is that going to be proportional to? The solute concentration, right? Okay. I think I'm going to talk about these two slides next week, and I'm going to finish up by talking about this slide right here. We have a red blood cell. What's surrounding that red blood cell? A plasma membrane, right? So guess what we want to be talking about? A membrane has to deal with osmosis. Okay, and in particular, that membrane around that red blood cell. All right, so let's just draw a couple beakers right here. So here we have a beaker. We've got a red blood cell in there, maybe a couple. And this is a selectively permeable membrane. And there are aquapores in this red blood cell, so water can actually move back and forth across the membrane. And let's just say, and the salt concentration inside this cell right here is about 0.9%, right, NaCl. If we measure all the solutes inside the cell, it's about 0.9%. All the glucose, all the sodium, all the potassium inside that cell. So how much water is inside this cell right here? If 0.9% is all the solutes, okay, how much solvent is in there? 99.1% water, H2O. Sorry for drawing it so small. Can you see that little water right there? Okay. Okay, now let's put this beaker in fresh water, like it's coming out of the tap right here, which basically has no solutes in it whatsoever. All right, so it's going to have 0% solute. And how much water? 100% water. And don't forget that salt can't get through the membrane Because it's what? Selectively permeable. It bounces off. But what about water? It can move. And which way is water going to move? By diffusion always. Low to high or high to low? High to low. What's higher? 100% or 99.1? Well, 100%. Does it seem like a big difference? Seems like a pretty small difference. But you're going to see that's actually huge. So water is going to enter this cell. And just like that little experiment we did first with the sliding membrane, what's going to happen to the shape of this cell as water moves in? It's going to swell up, right? It's going to get bigger, and it's going to get so big, even though that's a small difference in concentration of water, it's going to burst that cell, okay? And that process is what we call hemolysis. That cell is going to hemolyze. And the way that we talk about this water solution outside of the cell, we say that it is hypotonic. I misspelled it. So we're talking about tonicity, hypotonic. Okay, so a hypotonic solution is going to do what to cells? Yeah, it's going to burst them. It's going to lyse cells. And you know what? If you set up an IV and you don't get the tonicity of that solution right as you put it into somebody's body, what's going to happen to their red blood cells? They're going to blow up. Not good for the patient. Okay? Because once that cell blows up, can you ever put it back together again? No, that's an irreversible process. Right? Once a cell hemolyzes, it's destroyed forever. You can't put it back together again. All right? So a hypotonic solution will blow that cell up. Let's look at another condition. Right here, I'll try and draw it a little bit bigger. So here we have a cell. We got 0.9% NaCl in there. How much water is in this cell? 99.1% H2O. Now let's put this in seawater, salt water. And anybody know what the concentration of salt in salt water is? Dang, I don't know either. I meant to do a Google on that before class. It's not very much. Maybe it's about 3%. NaCl. So how much water is in seawater? Then 97% H2O. Not big difference, but water is going to diffuse across that membrane by concentration gradient. Again, which way is it going to go? High to low. So what's higher, 99.1 or 97? 99.1 is higher, so water is going to, well, it's going to diffuse out of the cell, but what's a better way of talking about that diffusion of water through this selectively permeable membrane? That is osmosis, right? That meets all the criteria for osmosis. So this cell is going to get all shrunken up and spiky looking, right? And that process is what we call crenation. And the kind of solution that causes crenation of cells is a salty solution, saltier than your body, and that's what we call a hypertonic solution. Hypertonic solution shrinks the cell down. Now, this is not necessarily an irreversible process. The cell is just shrunk down. Say you have a balloon full of air, and you let the air out. Can you blow the balloon back up again? Yeah. Right? But if you put so much air in the balloon, it bursts, you can't get the balloon back, right? So crenation is reversible. Hemolysis is an irreversible condition. So we can still help people that are dehydrated. Okay, this is kind of a really terrible condition right here. Does this ever happen to anybody? Can somebody have too much water in their body? You probably heard of that one case maybe 2 years ago where their radio station was holding a contest for a pickup truck, and they said, okay, whoever drinks the most water, okay, will win the pickup truck. And some people just started drinking water and water and water, gallons of water. I think somebody drank like 2.5 gallons of water. Well, where does all that water go? Right into these cells, and what happens to cells? They swell up, so your bodies swell up, but there's one part of your body that can't swell up because it's inside the cranial vault. Your brain can't expand, right? It does start to expand, but you know what happens? The brain gets pushed out of all of the foramina, like the foramen magnum. So your brain starts getting pushed out the foramen magnum and, you know, it was too late for that individual. Okay, I got 2 minutes left, all right? And I need to finish this up. All right, so you can die of water overdose. There's some drugs that actually make that happen. Anybody hear of methylene, diamine, methamphetamine, ecstasy? That gives you an inappropriate sensation of thirst. Okay, and people have overdosed on water because of that particular drug. All right, here we have a cell, once again. What's the concentration of salt? 0.9%. What's the concentration of water? 99.1. Okay, now let's make up a solution, an isotonic solution. All right, and the isotonic solution is going to have 0.9% NaCl and 99.1% water. Which way is water going to move? High to low. What's higher, 99.1 or 99.1? They're the same. So the amount of water moving in is going to equal the amount moving out, which means the cell is going to stay the same shape. All right, so the way that we talk about this solution is that it is isotonic. All right, so you might be familiar with different little solutions that you can give your infants to drink when it's really hot, or maybe they're vomiting, have diarrhea, to replace fluid in their bodies. And guess what kind of solution it is? Hypotonic, hypertonic, or isotonic? It should be what? Nice isotonic solution like PD Lite. Okay, would be something where you don't disturb the electrolyte balance or water balance of that little baby, which is obviously having problems. So you got to remember crenation. Crenation goes with hypertonic. Hemolysis goes with hypotonic. Now, is that really easy to remember? You could probably give this lecture if you know a little stupid trick. I'll tell you what this little trick is, as long as you don't tell anybody that I told you this. So you promise you won't tell anybody that I told you this? Okay, so here is an E in crenation, and here's an E in hypertonic. Here is an O in hemolysis. Here's an O in hypotonic. Okay, I know that's really stupid. But you should understand the mechanism, but, you know, if you're under pressure for time on a board exam or something, just remember that little rule. You can remember that for about a year or two, right? That's probably good enough. All right, so that will get you started. But you should know which way water is going to diffuse one way or the other. Yeah. Does water, that's a really tough one. Always, I would say most of the time, because you have that hydrophobic region in the membrane. Because it's a port, water won't have a natural tendency to diffuse the membrane because of that nonpolar region in the center of the membrane. So some places in your body can adjust the osmosis of cells, or the transport of water in and out of the cell, by inserting aquaporins in the membrane. And that's, for instance, what produces diuresis in people, right? Because there are hormones that will put aquaporins in the membrane so that water can move across the kidney tubule, for instance.
Because all our bodies need water, right?
Yeah. Most cells have sufficient aquaporins in them. Other cells, where they're regulated. They're regulated. They're taken out of the membrane or put in the membrane. Sometimes aquaporins are contained in endosomes. If they're in endosomes, they're inside the cell. But when the cell needs to transport water, those endosomes fuse to the plasma membrane, and now the aquaporins are in the plasma membrane and can move across the plasma membrane. There has to be a signal. Like anti-diuretic hormone.
Water
just can't move through
there.
Just can't move through. Yeah.
I just need a quick explanation one more time.
Okay.
So from, I look at